And none of it would have happened without all of you who've listened and watched as I, in the words of the great Edward R. Murrow, agitated the air. Many have kindly sent cards and messages and texts and tweets and even a few mementos about the way I've agitated the air, for which I am moved and grateful. For all of those things, all of those people, all of you people who've contributed to my advancement, I again say thank you. Have a good evening and be well.
Steve Murphy signed off from CTV Atlantic's News at 6 on November 30th, 2021, after 29 years, more than 8,000 broadcasts, and close to 5,000 interviews. That's where he picks up his latest book, Murphy's Logic, which carries the same title as his long-running opinion segment. We welcome Steve to Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast, to share his insights and reflect on the state of Canadian media after 45 years in the news business.
Hi, it's Steve Murphy here. You know, I can never remember a time in my life when I wasn't keen on broadcasting. I grew up in the 1960s with one black and white TV channel around which so much in the household revolved, particularly when Batman came on. And then I became a radio addict, I think, as a teenager, as we all did in the 1970s. And how lucky was I that in 1977, guys like Bob Lockhart and Ralph McLennigan and Derek Chase and Tommy Young hired me as a high school kid to go to work at CFBC in St. John. 50,000 watts of power right there in the Bay of Fundy. We grew up listening to all the great radio stations from Boston and Philly and Buffalo. And of course, we had great radio stations in the Maritimes too. And then I was very fortunate to graduate to CJCH in Halifax, the CHUM organization, a tremendous broadcasting company that also owned ATV, where I ended up as anchor of the 5 o'clock news and then eventually the 6 o'clock news on what became and is now CTV Atlantic. A job I had and loved for 30 years before I decided to shut off the battery pack and take off the IFB in December of 2021. That was then, and this is now.
And we've reached you in the Dominican Republic. This is where you wrote Murphy's Logic. Can you tell us about where you've been wintering?
Yeah, well, I live in the winter, Heather and I, in a beautiful town on the north coast called Cabaretti, which is, for those who've been to the Dominican, Connie, about half an hour from Puerto Plata Airport, a little, you know, tourist town. It's a windsurfing town, beautiful North Atlantic or Mid-Atlantic Ocean of the same kind we have on my coast, the Atlantic coast of Canada. And yes, when I got here last year, I had a deadline to deal with, Connie. And and we all as broadcasters know about deadlines. But my deadline was to have the manuscript finished for my publisher by the 17th of April, which I was able to do. But, you know, writing here, it was a real pleasure. Writing when you're sitting on the balcony, maybe even with a cold beer, makes it easier, although I did learn that after two or three beer, you probably have to do a rewrite in the morning.
You start Murphy's Logic off with your sign-off from CTV Atlantic in November of 2021, after close to 29 years with the station and 45 in broadcasting. You say it was the right time to stop and reflect. Can we talk a little bit about how you came to that decision?
Yeah, I had probably intended to go on a bit longer than I did, but I have a feeling that my decision, maybe like the decision of many others, in that it was influenced or accelerated, amplified by the pandemic. As you know, we had what amounted to basically one news story told 100 different ways every day during the early days and the mid-period of the pandemic. And then sadly, in Nova Scotia, we had the what is now called the mass casualty event of April of that year, an event that that was profoundly difficult, you know, to live for the people who had to live through it, the people who perished in it, and for those of us who covered it. I think we were all affected by it. So I think those events may have accelerated my decision to get out of the business when I did, the daily news business, because I'm still in the business in the peripheries. But, you know, you referred to my sign-off, Connie, which is be well, be well. And I don't know that I was feeling all that well. It's not that I didn't like the work. I just perhaps didn't like the way we were doing it in terms of the intensity of the same stories over and over again. So when I asked myself about my own wellness, I guess I concluded that this would be a good time to stop doing what I had been doing and had loved doing for so long and just turn down the speed a little bit.
I found this book to really be a personal love letter in some respects to local media in the Maritimes.
Thank you. Well, you know what? You know, and you of course have real credibility because you've worked in local media. I do love local media. I did love working in a small town radio station. I mean, St. John was a city of 120,000. We had two or three radio stations. We had 10 people in the newsroom in 1977. And then I came to Halifax, which was by no means a small town. It was a very robust, competitive media market with CJCH and CHNS, CFDR, all running big newsrooms. Our FM stations were running news programs, their own news departments, and so on. And it was a wonderful time, really, mid-70s through late 80s, to work in what I now recognize, and I think perhaps you would agree, was the golden age of commercial radio in terms of its ability to not only pay the bills, but make money. And it's a lot easier to do the job of news reporting properly when you're well-funded, which is the essential problem that all of our local news agencies broadcast, and otherwise, that's the essential problem they're having today. News costs money to make. And I don't know that our listeners, readers, or viewers have ever really had to pay the full price because the advertising model was so robust that the advertisers were carrying, most of the cost. Add to that the subscription fees that newspapers and magazines got and so on. And it was a robust environment in which to do the work. But the viewer, reader, listener never really had to pay the freight. Now they do.
One of the things that struck me is your willingness to acknowledge historical mistakes, including that some of the opinion pieces that you did over the years, you believe were harmful looking back.
Yeah, well, let me first stipulate that I started doing editorials, if you can imagine, on CFBC's FM station, which didn't have a huge listening audience, so it was very much a good place to start making making a fool of yourself. Yeah, no, some of those opinions were juvenile and silly. Some were ill-informed. Some of them, incidentally, were right. When you say something publicly by way of commentary every day, you're bound to get a few things right. But some of the opinion pieces I did later in my career, particularly the opinion piece I did about Donald Marshall Jr., the Indigenous Canadian man who was wrongfully convicted of a murder he did not commit. And I made comments about that case and about whether he ought to be compensated. And of course, subsequently, I learned that basically everything I believed about the case in the specific and about the lives of our Indigenous people in this country, almost everything I believed about it was ill-informed. So yes, I do see that as having been hurtful. I didn't intend to be hurtful, but that doesn't matter. The hurt was still committed, and I regret that.
It's refreshingly self-aware. You also acknowledge the struggle for women and people of color to break into the business in the early part of your career, saying yes, that most newsmen were blissfully unaware that we were beneficiaries of both white privilege and male privilege. I really love that because too often there's a preponderance to glorify the heyday of broadcasting without acknowledging that. Why did you feel it was important to include some of those details?
Well, I don't know. I guess it just became so transparently clear in hindsight that when I went into the first newsroom I worked in 1977, it was a male bastion. And when Betsy Smith was hired as our first, in at least the first female that I worked with, Deneen Baldwin, who was a trailblazer in broadcasting, had worked at CFBC before. But when Betsy was hired, and by the way, I had the pleasure of running into Betsy again for the first time in almost 50 years during a little book tour I did. But when Betsy was hired, I think we all realized that, we couldn't continue with the attitudes that we had and some of the behaviors we had because, frankly, they just weren't appropriate. But what was really not appropriate is that it had taken so long for women to be given the opportunity to work in the business. And then I was really fortunate that I worked with so many outstanding people, so many outstanding women in the business, many of whom have gone on to run the news industry in this country. I worked with Sue Margetti back many, many years ago. She's just wrapped up a fabulous career at CBC. I worked with Anna Maria Tremonti, not in the same newsroom, but we shared news stories. She was at CFNB and CKEC in New Glasgow when I was in St. John and Halifax. And then I did work with her across the hall when she was at C100 and I was doing the mornings on CJCH. So yes, no, I think it's so clear in hindsight, but you know, cliches don't get to be cliches without being wrong. Hindsight is always 20/20, but it's important to look in the rearview mirror and realize what is it the little sign says that the images, you know, maybe not exactly as they appear or something to that effect. You know, we now see with clarity what was not so clear at the time.
So I want to get into the weeds here, Steve. You devoted a whole chapter to the idea of media bias, and on that note, suggests that the federal government's attempt to prop up journalism with tax credits maybe is doing more harm than good. Why do you feel that way, Steve?
Well, I feel that way, Connie, because, you know, we're inside the business, and I assume many of the people listening to us are inside the business, and we don't see ourselves sometimes as our viewers, listeners, and readers do. And I think we need to be very aware of any perception that we are being influenced in inappropriate ways. It's one thing, of course, that we, by and large, in the business have ownership. Much of it's large corporate ownership. Our listeners, readers, and viewers are already somewhat suspicious of that. They wonder, you know, who do we work for? Are we working for the viewer, reader, listener, or are we working for the people who pay our paychecks? And the answer is both. We do hopefully serve the public, but we do work for people. I don't know that we want to be seen as, you know, working in quotation marks for the government, because really, particularly news journalism programs and so on, need to be beyond arm's length from politics. So the idea that government is helping media might be misunderstood by our listeners, readers, and viewers, and I fear that it has been. And I don't know whether you sense what I sense about a growing, not only skepticism, but there is some hostility now toward the media. And some of it, I think, is born of the idea that we're in somebody's pocket. And I don't think we are in somebody's pocket. I mean, we do work for people, and there are legitimate questions about perspective. The media in general may have tilted too far philosophically in one direction or another, but that isn't what I'm driving at. I'm driving at the perception that somehow we're owned, and we can't have that and succeed. And I think we need to go out of our way to try to avoid that. On the other hand, this is an existential crisis we're experiencing in media in the country and in local newsrooms, which we were speaking of earlier. And I think it's going to require a good deal of thoughtful public policy to help turn it around.
I'm going to ask you more about that. You really take issue with the entire structure of the Canadian broadcast system. You had a really interesting question that you posed in the book. Is it in the public interest for the public broadcaster to be the country's dominant news source, which is what CBC's mass and not-for-profit funding model are allowing it to become?
Right.
CBC president's job is coming open, Steve. What what direction do you think the public broadcaster should be headed in?
Well, I think for starters, we need to revisit. And this is, by the way, I think it's the 85th year since the commission that recommended the creation of the CRBC. I believe that was 85 years ago, be that as it may. It's an appropriate time to ask what the role of the public broadcaster should be, you know, whether it should include all of the media engagements that the CBC is presently involved with. And we should also look at the question of whether the funding model for CBC is allowing one organization, in this case, a Crown Corporation, to become too big. Because if concentration of ownership is a legitimate issue in media, and I agree that it is, I think concentration of perspective is also a very serious concern. And I say that not because I necessarily question the perspective, but I do think it's not wise to allow relatively few people and one or two editorial philosophies to govern so much of the nation's news. Now, if I sound like a bitter private broadcaster, there may be a little bit of resentment there only in this sense. Even with its struggles, and it has many, and even with its cuts, and it's had many, the CBC still is far more robust now in its newsrooms than are the private newsrooms. And that is only possible because of the stability of the government subsidy. And I think we do need to have a conversation that looks at both the funding model and the mandate of a modern Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. But I want to add this, Connie, and I don't think this will surprise you if you've read the book. I support public broadcasting, and I think we need a CBC. But I think it's completely fair, and indeed it's appropriate, to reconsider its role and reconsider its funding model.
You must have thoughts on the drastic rounds of layoffs we've been seeing across all forms of media. Do you see a sustainable path forward for journalism?
Well, you know, Connie, it's tough. I mean, it is true that many of our newsrooms in the country now are in the care of large corporations. Some people expect, because large corporations make a lot of money, that they should subsidize local newsrooms. Some have even gone so far as to suggest that that perhaps should be a regulatory consideration. The CRTC perhaps should become involved and so on. But let me point out that the large corporations that own some of the media in the country are under no obligation to hang on to the broadcast licenses they now have. And in fact, I believe there was a case not long ago in Ottawa where Rogers gave back a license rather than continue operating a money-losing proposition. So I don't think there's any guarantee that if push comes to shove, which it may well do, that the large corporations will continue to want to be in the regulated broadcast environment. And that raises the question of, if corporations, large corporations, can't make a go of it, who can? Now, maybe there are smaller local businesses that could. And in fact, we've seen examples in this country. I think of CH and Hamilton, where, the company went back into a different ownership model and it seems to be doing well. I'm not privy to the balance sheets. But there may be other models. But I don't know that the idea that the regulator through regulation is going to force owners to behave in a certain way, I don't know that that's legitimate, because in the end, you can't require an owner to keep a license they don't want. And owners can turn back licenses. And I think that's a possibility we need to consider as well. I do lament, strongly lament, the loss of jobs in news, and not just because I so regret the loss of so many talented people from the business, some of whom I know, but I lament it for the listeners, readers, and viewers, because when there are fewer of us in there stirring the pot, there's less soup for everybody. And we need more information, more reliable, edited, credible, authoritative information in this age, not less. We need more. But as I say in the book, news is not free. It comes with a price tag. The price tag has never really been clearly visible to readers, listeners, and viewers, because the advertising model did such a good job of supporting it. But the advertising model is now broken, and we need to take a look at it and see whether it can be fixed. There's no easy fix, I know that for sure.
I lament the loss of all the institutional knowledge leaving some of those newsrooms. And that struck me when I read your book, is, just the volume of political knowledge alone, Steve, that you include in Murphy's Logic. A lot of newsrooms don't have, those voices anymore.
Well, you're right. And another of the things I lament in the book is the loss of context in reporting. And newsrooms also need to have what I would call the context that is provided by those who've been around for a long time. It is institutional knowledge, but it's also very important contextually when it comes to reporting stories. It's helpful if you've got people who can remember the last time this happened, or who have a long enough memory to remember when the person saying one thing today was saying something different then. Yes, I agree with you. I think that is also a loss. And it's not only a loss to the newsroom, it's a loss to the viewer, reader, and listener as well. Because, information requires context. And context is in many, I think demonstrably, in many cases, comes from experience. And when you lose experience, I think you threaten context.
You asked Ian Hanna-Mansing to write the foreword for this book. You two have a long history going all the way back to high school.
Yeah, we go, we do. We go back to, I think it's 1976 or 1977. Ian and I were both on the New Brunswick Provincial High School debate team in the national championships that year in St. Catharines, Ontario. And Ian was raised in Sackville, New Brunswick. I was raised in St. John. So we didn't know each other except through debating, but we became pretty good friends. And then we've stayed in contact regularly throughout our careers. And we had lunch with Ian and Nancy when they were in Halifax a couple of summers ago. And in fact, the photo of the two of us was taken that day. So when it came time to do a foreword for the book, the publisher said, well, who do you have in mind? And I had a couple of people in mind. I said, but the person I really would love to have do it is Ian, because he's known me for my entire adult life. And he knew me before broadcasting, you know, and he knew me during and now after daily broadcasting. So he very graciously agreed to do it. And I was completely thrilled and honored by what he wrote. He's a very good writer. You know, he's one of our best journalists and broadcasters in Canada. And I was deeply flattered that my old friend would so honor me by doing that.
He has a very interesting note in that introduction. But if I hadn't met Steve, if I didn't realize it might just be possible for a teenager to get a job in a radio newsroom, I might never have given it a shot. I hope this book has the same impact on young people with a dream to go on air.
He's too kind. You know? I have a feeling, given the great talent and wit and genius of Ian, that he would have found himself exactly where he is. But he's kind to give me even a scintilla of credit. But no, it's his own hard work and superior talent that has landed Ian where he is. But I suppose I did inspire him only in the sense that we were a couple of high schoolers and I had a job and he wanted one. So he went on to have great jobs too, put himself through law school working at CHNS in Halifax, and worked at CKDH in Amherst, at CKCW in Moncton, and then of course famously at CBC. But no, Ian is very, very generous and very kind. But I think the facts bear out my view, which is that with brains and talent, I think Ian would have gone exactly where he is.
I think you've inspired a lot of young broadcasters along the way, including our Broadcast Dialogue publisher, Sean Smith. He says you were very kind to him when he was a young broadcaster. But my question is, should we still be encouraging a lot of young people to go into journalism? I know a lot of broadcast journalists are very divided on this.
Yeah, I think we should continue to encourage people to get into the news business, into journalism, and we should make it clear to them that what they now see, hear, or read might not be what they end up doing, because I think the media are changing. But look, Connie, the need has never been greater in this society for a well-informed populace. And in order to have a well-informed populace, we need smart and honest people who want to get into the business of journalism and broadcasting and who want to tell the truth and want to tell stories fairly, accurately, and with balance. And it doesn't really matter to me on what screen the work appears, or whether it's audio or video, or whether it's print or text. It doesn't matter, because it's the quality of the content that matters. And if you want high quality content, you've got to recruit the high quality people to create it.
The book initially sold out, but I gather it's available again. How can people get a copy?
You know, this is the part of the business I don't know very much about. I know my publisher, which is Nimbus in Halifax, Atlantic Canada's leading publisher, proud to work with them again, Nimbus.ca, I believe they have the book. And I think most of the major booksellers in the country would also be able to access it either online or through their retail, certainly the big ones. But I like to promote buy local, buy regional, buy national, buy Canadian. And then, you know, if you can't do it that way, then go to Amazon, I guess. But
is there a thought you want to close on, Steve?
Only that, you know, you mentioned Sean and Broadcast Dialogue. I just want to mention that, you know, Broadcast Dialogue has been a must read for me for as long as I can remember. But my whole point is, you know, it's sort of a bit of a Bible for our business in Canada. And I don't know anybody inside the business or many of us who are now sort of just, you know, nibbling around on the outside, who doesn't look forward to that weekly briefing. And I think it's just a great thing that we've still been able to retain it in the country. So good on you, and good on my old buddy Sean.
Thanks so much for joining us, Steve. It was my pleasure.
Hey, thank you, Connie. Thanks.
For listening to Broadcast Dialogue. For more information about the podcast or to receive exclusive access to our weekly briefing about the Canadian media industry, visit us at broadcastdialogue.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, connect with us on LinkedIn, and follow us on Twitter and SoundCloud.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.